that recording now. But this story was one that I actually spoke about a month ago at a shul up north in Thorn Hill, Zichron Yisrael. They wanted me to speak about a contemporary issue from Agnon. And I chose this because it speaks to the problems of Hasidim and Misnagdim, but it's really the issue of strife within communities. And unfortunately, this isn't a happy story. This doesn't have a happy ending. But at the same time, it's so wonderful a story. Mm-hmm. It's so dramatic, and it's so powerful that it just draws me. Now, I have to warn you, the oneg that I did this story at ended up running 2 hours. We're not running 2 hours with it, but it ran 2 hours because no one there had read the story before. And so what I did with my translation that you have here was to go through the translation with them just to give them a flavor of the story and to introduce them to Agnon, because they didn't know anything about him. You do. So we don't have to spend the time introducing who Agnon is. And I hope you have some familiarity with the story already. We can focus more on what's here and what the messages are in the course of our discussion. One thing that I do always insist on is you have to interrupt me in the middle. Don't wait to the end with your questions, because I won't give you time for questions at the end. Then you have to just stop me. That's a core principle for those who don't know me. Okay. So, without further ado, then Hanidach, the banished one. So I gave you a reference here in source number one, which is after you get through the story itself, from Arnold Band, who has written extensively on Agnon, translated Agnon, about this story. He says, I didn't put page numbers on the pages, I probably should have, but it's right, it's the source number one after you get through the story itself.
2 pages from the
end.
Yeah. The suspense of the story is created by the deliberately slow pace in which Agnon works his way to the inevitable tragic ending. Situation by situation, we learn more about Gershom, who's the one we're going to see most about in the story, begin to understand him as a person, and consequently watch his steady progress to his doom in sympathy and horror. The drama of Gershom is played out on two levels. On the metaphysical plane, he is doomed because of the curse of Reb Uriel, the Hasidish Rebbe in the story. Hence, the innocent victim of an ideological clash. On the psychological plane, he is victimized by his own hypersensitivity. Both tensions, the metaphysical ideological and the purely psychological, convulse the tranquil folkloristic milieu, resulting in the inevitable death.
That's quite a sentence.
Yeah, isn't it? The band has a taste for the dramatic as well. So nothing in this story is going to be unintentional. Everything here is driving towards conveying these messages, as I hope we'll see. But I did want to note one other thing before we talk about the story. And that is, and Shoshana and I actually exchanged emails about this, because she noted this in another story of Agnon. The battle between Hasidim and Misnagdim. You have it there. Okay, thank you. The battle between Hasidim and Misnagdim is very meaningful for Agnon. The city of Buchech, where he was born and to which he harks back in the story under the name of Shibush, was a hotbed for strife between Hasidim and Misnagdim long before Agnon, at the end of the 18th century. A little bit more background, just in case it's not familiar to people, I apologize if it is. Hasidim begin their movement the end of the 18th century. At this point in Jewish life in Eastern Europe, Jewish achievement is defined based on intellectual advancement. You study in the yeshiva, you memorize Talmud, you go to the yeshiva in Volozhin, which begins at the end of the 18th century. That's the definition of success. Piety is measured by asceticism, right? You stay away from this worldly things. You give away your wealth to tzedakah. You don't go out getting drunk, certainly. Religious expression is very personal. Prayer is quiet. Into this realm, the Hasidim come with a new raft of ideas. They pray jubilantly, and it looked like Baptists, right? Up and down, dancing and jumping and singing, crying out loud, gesturing. They teach that every soul is pure and ideal and perfect, even though the Rebbe has a greater soul than others. Nonetheless, we are all equal, just some are more equal than others. They teach that you can reach God through what's called in Hebrew dveikut, or as Hasidim would say, dveikus, by clinging to God, drawing close to God, which can be a feeling. You can have that whether you're a wagon driver or a Torah scholar. It doesn't make a difference. You're thinking about Hashem. You're thinking about God when you do it, and therein lies spiritual purity. They were heavily mystical in their view of the soul, in their view of the Rebbe, in their view of the way you affect this world. And because of the mysticism, they roused suspicion. Because 100 years before this was the false Messiah, Shabtai Tzvi, who brought forth all these Kabbalistic ideas and ended up leading Jews into destruction. There were people who sold all their assets thinking he was going to lead them to Jerusalem and be the Messiah. And there were people who bought into what he did, and then he converted to Islam, and they didn't know what to make of that. And then after his time, you find a sort of Jewish Christian group under the leadership of Jacob Frank taking up the mantle of Sabbateanism and mysticism. So mysticism gets a very bad name. And when Hasidim start teaching it, it becomes, well, what is this? The Shabtai Tzvi all over again, and particularly because they have this cult of personality surrounding the Rebbe. There's a lot of suspicion. Plus, with their teachings about the importance of your personal intent comes the idea that intent trumps all the other laws of Judaism. So, it is alleged that the early Hasidim would say, if you're sitting there on Passover and you're about to eat the matzah, but you don't feel the departure from Egypt, don't eat the matzah. Wait. Maybe Sukkot time you'll eat the matzah. I'm not kidding. That's what was alleged. Whether it was true or not, I don't know. But that's what was alleged. And this led to like fist fights in the street over it. This led to people going to the government to rat on the other side in order to cause the government to act against them. The Hasidim, for their part, in a brilliant move of marketing, branded those who were the mainstream misnagdim. Lihitnagid. What is Lihitnagid? To oppose. So the opposition.
The name Mitnagdim was not chosen by Mitnagdim.
Oh no, it was chosen by the Hasidim. Because what that does is now we're the mainstream and they're the opposition. Brilliant marketing. Really, a tremendous move. So Bacek is a hotbed for this strife, and particularly in the time of Rabbi Avram David of Bacek, also known as the Eshel Avram. Eshel Avram is the name of his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, to the Code of Jewish Law. And it's very important to know about him because of the pivotal moment in this story, which actually is pulled from his life. So take a look, please, in source number 2. This is from a book about, or an article online, I should say, about the Bacek community. Bacek, number 2, was characterized by people like Rabbi Avram David ben Usher. That's who I just mentioned. His life history and philosophy constitute a very important chapter of Bacek's history. We shall, however, suffice with a concise account of his story. As a boy, he already drew attention to himself by his great Talmudic erudition and sharpness. Tzvi Hirsch, author of Netzach HaShoeim, chose him as a son-in-law for his daughter. I assume his daughter was asked, but I don't know. At 20, he was ready to serve as the rabbi of Yazlovich. Bacek was a town of scholars and Talmudists who did not believe. Yeah, it's number 2. Who did not believe in the tzaddikim and their miracles. Right, this is a town of what would be called misnagdim. The war between the Talmudists and the Hasidim reached its peak at that time, and it greatly troubled Rav Avram. When his son fell ill, his wife and friends urged him to bring the sick child to Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, a Hasid if there ever was one. After refusing for a long while, he finally consented, and from that day on, he was a different man. He was greatly influenced by Rav Levi Yitzchak, who helped him in reconciling his Talmudic and Hasidic views, positions that were polarized in his town. The Hasidim could not imagine a greater joy, for many of them feared his mastery of the Talmud and rabbinical law. Nevertheless, after he inherited his father-in-law's position, and he became the rabbi, everyone marveled at his religious knowledge, but opposed his way of life. Following the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov. So they loved him as a misnagid, but he was a chassid. In the practice of rabbinical law, he would draw his judgment from the Talmud, from rabbinical authorities, poskim, not from the principles of the Kabbalah. His wide-ranging literary work was basically rationalistic, Talmudic, exegetic. You could read his Eish El Avram on the Code of Jewish Law, and it would never dawn on you that there was anything Hasidic or mystical about him. It's as dry can be. His essay, Da'at Kedoshim, as well as Eish El Avram, was incorporated as an independent section of the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. In addition to all of his other books, he wrote a Kabbalistic commentary named Birkat David, David's Blessing. At one point in his life, his reason was somewhat shaken, and according to tradition, he was cured by the rabbi of Sassov. He acted as the judge's rabbi till the day he died, approximately 50 years, and bestowed his spirit upon the town of being open to Chassidus, even though he was intellectually a misnagid. I've known himself as a product of a mixed marriage. I've known his father's family is Hasidic, and his mother's family are misnagdim. So I've known writes quite a bit about them. If you read A Guest for the Night, that's an example of a story where that employs this Shalom, Shalom, Ve'in Shalom, and then Shoshana said that she found it in which one?
Oh, it's all over in his writings, but this book is Bachanuto Shel Mar Lublin, and this takes place in Germany in World War I, but the Hasidim are very prominent, and misnagdim. Off and on. I'll give you the page and you'll see.
Okay, thank you.
I was going to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Maybe other people. I'm very ignorant. I read the story many times and I read it quickly this time. What was the curse of Rav Uriel?
Oh, we'll get to it.
Okay? Oh, you will get to it.
Oh, yes. Yeah, you can't do the story without it. So you've hit on a key point. So this story is actually backdated. He writes the story between 1909 and 1919. But think of it as happening at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, when the Hasidim are on the rise, but not yet powerful. They're still getting kicked out of towns. That's what we're talking about. So, outline of the story, okay? And I'm going to do the outline of the story relatively quickly, in the interest of getting to everything else. But you have the story here. You have the translation with my annotations on it. I've actually upgraded them since I printed it. There's more than what you have, but that's whatever. I had to print it at some point. But the story begins, and I'm going to refer to the document you have, to the pages here. So you'll see it. The numbers that are in parentheses are based on this book. This is my edition of Elu Ve'elu in which it appears. So if you have Elu Ve'elu, the edition that I have, page 9 in here is where you see a 9 in your translation. Okay. So he begins the story with this description about a Thursday in Bechech. There's snow falling. The black earth turns white, the heavens remain dull, people go into their homes. There's a feeling of sadness. Between oven and stove is a term from the Talmud that's used for somebody who's sitting and grieving, sitting between the oven and the stove, being Tanur L'Kirayim. No one departed or entered, Ein Yotzei Ve'Ein Baz, description in Tanakh of the city of Jericho, when they're anticipating the Jewish assault on the city. So there's a feeling of being under siege. Suddenly on the fifth day, things are good. The trait of chesed triumphed, which is a phrase that you find in Hasidic thought, the writings of the Sfat Emet. Chesed is kindness. The sun shines, the snow begins to melt. Ah, we get a break. Right? You know what that feels like, right? When we've had terrible weather and suddenly there's some sun. So suddenly there was a little bit of that feeling at one point. But suddenly the sun came out. You familiar with Birkas HaChama? There's a blessing that's recited every 28 years when everything in the heavens is supposed to come into sync. It's to be synchronized with. It was 8 years ago already.
Eight years ago already.
It was my last year before coming here. That's why I remember. It was Erev Pesach. But it said every 28 years when the heavens come in sync. However, if you look at the passage in the Talmud from which the blessing is learned, some argue that's not what the line says. That the way to read the line is that if you've had 3 days of clouds and then the sun comes out, that's when you're supposed to say such a blessing. And I actually buy that explanation because that's the way it feels, you know. The line in the Talmud is, Harachama bitkufata. So some take it as tkufa, like the season. And it means when everything is back to the way it was at creation. But tkufa can also be like from tokef in its strength. In any case, that's a complete side note. Anyway, the sun shines, the snow begins to melt. I skipped a little bit as I had to, because it's 47 pages, this story. And it's starting towards evening, and everybody gathers for prayers, and suddenly these elderly women break through the door to seek mercy for Adel. Adel is the daughter of the Parnas. The Parnas is responsible for the community. He is the one who funds things, frankly, when they need funding. He raises funds. He oversees the community's organizations. It's a position of great respect and a position of great power. And his daughter, Adel, is sick. So they open up the arm. They hug the Torah scrolls and they pray on her behalf. I'm not going to tell you about every annotation that I put on here. You have it there if you want to see it. But we just want to get through the story right now. So suddenly there's news. After Mincha, after the afternoon service, Tzaddik has come to town, which is a classic phrase. Tzaddik Balair is always with the way the Hasidim, that's what they put on their banners when some Rebbe is going to visit. Tzaddik Balair, the Tzaddik has come to town. And the Hasidim, few of them that are in the city, are very excited. The Rebbe has had mercy on our city, he's going to greet us, maybe he's going to heal Adel, right? Because in Hasidic, the Rebbe performs miracles. So he's going to heal the daughter of Rabbi Avigdor, the Parnas. However, those who know better know Rabbi Avigdor, and he hates the Hasidim like you wouldn't believe. You'll see it in the story. It's the last thing in the world that he would want. He wants to kick out the Hasidim. Nonetheless, the Hasidim in the city go out on Friday morning to go greet the Tzaddik who has arrived. They said, not only they go, but also those who are curious, who need to justify for themselves that they're going out to greet him. Right? Did you notice that in it? Well, you know, if he's a tzaddik, the entrance of tzaddikim causes awe of heaven. If people thirst to see him, that's a sign that God is with him. In other words, I'm not going because I'm chassid, but, you know, it's valuable to go, so therefore I'm going to go. So you have people who are curious, people who are hangers-on, they want to know what all the excitement is about with the chassidim. And they all go out to greet him. His intimates are energized, and they draw close to the Merkava, and I did not translate that word. Mm. What is a Merkava?
It's
a chariot with a
chariot.
Correct, but it also is a chariot with a capital C.
Right. Right.
Merkava in Kabbalistic thought is the divine throne. And that's why he chooses the word and emphasizes it here. It's the chariot of the Rebbe. No, he had a wagon, but it's the chariot of God. And so they greet the rabbi and they untie the horses and they put themselves in the place of the horses. We are going to pull the chariot along. And the rabbi, the Rebbe, he goes back and forth between Rav and Rebbe in the story, which I found interesting. But he descends from the Merkava to mix with them, and they say, what are you doing? We're trying to pull you along. And he says, your love for the mitzvah, your passion for the mitzvah is so great, I have to be with you. And that's quintessential Hasidic idea. And they all expect miracles. So there's a Jewish householder who doesn't have any children and he wants to be able to have kids. And he says, well, I'll bring the Rebbe into my home. I'm not a chassid, but maybe it'll rub off and maybe I'll be able to have a child. And there's such love between them. And at the same time, and Agnon uses that phrase repeatedly here when he wants to juxtapose things. So at the same time, we're at the paragraph that starts with the number 11, if you're following in the translation. At the same time, Rabbi Avigdor leaves the room of his sick daughter, Adel. So while they are rejoicing purely and innocently with their Rebbe, Rabbi Avigdor leaves the sick room of his daughter. He hears the Hasidim. And instead of saying, I want to go greet the Rebbe, and maybe the Rebbe can do something, he says, how long will this sin be stored with me? Which is a phrase taken from King David. The Talmud describes God asking King David, how long will you be responsible for the destruction of the city of Nob, where you were a fugitive from King Saul, and they supported you, and they were destroyed? It was because of you that they were destroyed. That's what Avigdor is saying to himself. He says, I am guilty for the fact that there are Hasidim in this town, and the fact that the Rebbe is here. I better do something about it. So what does he do? He leaves the sickbed of his daughter, who is dying, and he dresses up so that he can go to the Paritz. What's the Paritz? Right, the local noble, right, who's not Jewish, and get him to act against this Rebbe who has come to town. That's what he's doing at the same time that the Hasidim are all reveling and celebrating. So all the Hasidim are very excited that the Rebbe is here. They all get ready for Shabbos. They make wonderful food. They put on their white clothing. They're all excited. But as he puts it, the satanic deed triumphs. The noble, the Paritz, goes along with the request, and they're going to chase out Rabbi Uriel. Well, at this point, Rabbi Uriel, it's Friday morning, is wearing his talis and tefillin. His face is shining from his prayer. He's still praying. Now, it doesn't have to be morning anymore, keep in mind. One of the hallmarks of the Hasidim is they don't care what time of day it is. They'll start davening Shacharis at 10 a.m., and that's just fine. So I don't know when this is, but at some point, Reb Uriel is still davening. And the officer from the noble comes to him and says, "You got to get out." And Reb Uriel removes his tefillin. He wraps their straps like the wings of a dove. That's pulled from the Talmud. There's a story in the Talmud about a period when the Romans had decreed that the Jews were not allowed to wear tefillin. And there was a Jew named Elisha Baal Kenafayim, because of this story. Before the story, he's just Elisha, who wears tefillin in defiance of the Roman order. And a Roman sees him and runs after him, and he runs away. And the Roman is going to catch him. He takes off the tefillin, he holds it in his hands. The Roman catches up to him and says, "What's in your hand?" And he says, "Dove's wings." And the Roman says, "Open him up." And he opens his hand, and sure enough, it's the wings of a dove. I hope there was a whole dove. Gross. But but it's based on a verse. Kanfeyo nanechbe bekesef. There are mitzvot are like the wings of a dove coated in silver. That's the image of that's being used in the Talmud. But now think about it. What Avnon is doing is he's comparing the Jew, the Chassid, persecuted by Avigdor, by the Misnagdim, with a Jew persecuted by the Romans. You Misnagdim, you're like the Romans, coming after the Rebbe like this. And the officer is in some awe of the Rebbe. He's like, "Please, you know, you should go." He goes. And the group of Hasidim stand and they cry, "Hamas!" Right? The term for violence. They say, "They've done terrible things to us. We have to take revenge." And now here's the key. The paragraph that starts 12. Here is the curse. I'm jumping to his holy heart in the paragraph that starts with the number 12. His holy heart was awakened, meaning the Rebbe. He's upset. He's angry. They're calling for blood. But he said, "Uriel, Uriel," he talks to himself, "are you truly concerned for the honor of his name, or are you concerned for your own honor? And how will you know the truth?" Meaning he challenges himself. Am I going to take revenge? Am I really concerned about God, or am I just doing it because they kicked me out and I'm humiliated and therefore I want to take revenge? And at this moment, he could go either way. But nature triumphed, and he cursed the Parnas. And a harsh curse was uprooted from his mouth, that one who was, and now I think I wrote pushed away in yours, but I changed it afterwards to say one who was banished, because that's what we always translate, hanidach, which is the word that's used here in the Hebrew. One who was banished would be banished from him. Right now I have to explain what that means, but I want to finish this, the line. And all who were present nodded in their heads and said, "He has bitten Avigdor in his tail like a serpent. Woe to him, woe to him. So is good for him, so is appropriate for him." That's the curse. Now, what is the story behind this curse? So, you have to know the story behind this curse, because it's one of the key elements of this story and one of the things I can add to the understanding of those who have already read this story. First of all, this curse comes from a verse in Shmuel, in the book of Samuel, chapter, I brought it on your sheet. Jump ahead, please, to source number 3. Samuel 2, chapter 14, sentence 14. This verse that we're talking about is a verse that is meant in context to say that God makes sure that people are punished from sin so that they will not be kept away from him. In other words, if someone has done something wrong, God is going to punish them in this world so that they can be reunited with him once they've been cleansed of their guilt. That's what the line means in context. It's from the story of David and Avshalom. Avshalom has sinned horribly, that's its own story, and David is convinced to take him back by someone who says this sentence to him. And read the line. Kimos Nemus, he says, "We will certainly die. We are like water spilled on the ground, which will not be gathered in. God will not show favor to anyone. But he plans, God plans, lest anyone who has been pushed away, banished, remain pushed away. So the image in the sentence is a positive one. Livelty, that we should not be
that's
pushed
not,
away.
Right.
But he uses that same curse.
Without the word
livelty. Without livelty. Yeah. He says, no, that the one who has been pushed away should be pushed away. That those who are going to be banished should be banished forever. And the idea is, Rabbi Victor is going to lose someone from his house. That's the curse that he issues. You follow? But there's more. Take a look, please, at source number 6. I'm jumping a little bit on the sheet, but it's for a reason. This is from a book called Sefer Derot HaChadash. Unquestionably, this is what Agnon reads before he writes this story. You'll see why. This is a story about the rabbi I mentioned before, Rabbi Avram David of Bechetch, who was a misnagid, right? But learns to love the ways of the Hasidim. And as a result, gains enemies. Okay? In the interest of time, I'm going to read it in the English, but I brought you the Hebrew so you could see it as well, and I retyped it myself, so take time. It once happened with the great and holy Rabbi Avram David of Bechetch, author of Birkat David, that he went to the outhouse, and one of his opponents locked him in the outhouse for about an hour. The righteous and holy sage was very upset because of the fumes, and because he needed to narrow his holy thoughts, for he never ceased thinking holy thoughts, cleaving to the creator of all. He has to go through this hour without thinking of Torah and thinking of God, because he's in an outhouse, it's inappropriate. And when his household realized, they found out what had happened, they opened the door for him. They said he should avenge himself against his enemies and issue a ban against them for the honor of heaven and Torah. He almost listened to their counsel, and he took a shofar to trumpet the ban. That's what you used in a rabbinical court to declare a ban on somebody. You blew a shofar. But then the Holy One said to himself, "Tell me, are you truly and completely concerned for the honor of his name and his Torah? Perhaps you are concerned for your own honor. How will you know the truth?" The same words that Agnon puts in the mouth of Rabbi Uriel. In a moment, the Holy One became someone else and refrained. So Rabbi Avram David of Bechetch holds himself back. He restrains himself in his anger. Rabbi Uriel does not. And therein lies part of the guilt in this story, is that Rabbi Uriel, so incensed about the way he has been humiliated, being kicked out of the town, issues a curse that his better, Rabbi Avram David of Bechetch, did not. You follow? That's why I wanted to make sure to identify the Rabbi Avram David of Bechetch. Yes?
Forgive me.
No.
Bechetch.
I know, I'm sorry. I say Bechetch because that's the way I learned it in yeshiva. But long before I knew anything about Agnon, before I knew anything about Hasidim.
But Bechetch is the way they...
Okay.
The country calls it...
Bechetch. There is nothing to apologize for, and I accept it, and I am likely to say Bechetch anyway. Just because it's what we call in Aramaic, Girsa Diankuta. It's what you learn it when you're a kid. You know, I've been saying Bechetch for 30 years without ever knowing anything about this story. It was wrong. I've been wrong for 30 years.
Because the Yiddish speakers, you know, have other names. They call it Bechuch and all kinds of strange names, so everybody has their own.
Okay. Then I'm in good company in being wrong.
The way you pronounce it is what? Is the way the grain is pronounced?
Yeah, the Russians and the map and in Slavic, it's Bechetch. That's the name.
Okay. Bechetch it is. I'll do my best.
Yeah.
Or I'll call it Shibush. No wonder Agnon called it Shibush. Okay. Wait, controversy? Yeah, because they're all confused about what the name of their city is. Fine. Okay. So Rabbi Uriel issues this curse on Rabbi Victor the Parnas. So Rabbi Uriel leaves the city. The Hasidim leave with him. The snow is melting. The road is all rutted. And they walk along reciting Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs. You have to pay attention to the role of Song of Songs in this story. I'm going to sum it up at the end, but notice where it comes up. Why are they singing Song of Songs?
Friday
afternoon. This is one of the things that Hasidim say on a Friday, not only Hasidim, Hasidim certainly say on a Friday afternoon, because Song of Songs is a song of love between God and the Jewish people. with all the crises that are built into it, but it's the up and down relationship. So Rav Uriel is reciting one verse about how he's been attacked, and the group of Hasidim recite a verse about his beauty. It's very nice sort of back and forth. Well, the innkeeper outside of town sees them coming, and he thinks, oh no, what happened? Why are they leaving the city? Is there something wrong? They tell him the story, and oh, is he overjoyed with the joy of a simpleton? That's a phrase from the Tanya. I've known is very familiar with a lot of Hasidus. A lot of his stuff comes from Rabbi Nachum of Breslov. But this phrase, the joy of a simpleton, is brought in the Tanya to describe a simpleton who gets to host a human king. He says, if you could host a human king, you'd be so happy. How much more so to host God in your home? And he's using it here because he's getting to host the Rebbe. It's the joy of a simpleton. The innkeeper is overjoyed. He says, you know, a victor, he wouldn't let us have a minion in our village. He said it would weaken this shul in town. It would weaken their receipts when people are supposed to make donations. Ha! He drove them out. Now we're going to get our minion after all. And he says, don't worry, we have meat, we have fish. And he goes to greet the Rebbe. He's not dressed properly for Shabbos. That causes a little bit of consternation. But fundamentally, the Rebbe says, you can't grieve. It's Shabbos. We have to celebrate with whatever we have. And they welcome Shabbos, they sing Lecha Dodi, they dance, and at the bottom, well not at the bottom, I have a different pagination than you do, the paragraph that starts 14, we're told that Rav Uriel would normally minimize Torah speech. He didn't like telling Divrei Torah, which, if you're on the Snagid, you're like, what do you mean? Of course you do, you're the teacher. But he doesn't do that, because he says, it is not speaking of Torah that's important, but doing and fulfilling the words of Torah. But here he gives a Divrei Torah about the Parsha, and the Parsha is Vayetze Yaakov. Well, I mean, that's I've known at his finest, because Vayetze Yaakov is the Torah portion that describes Yaakov having to flee from his brother Esav, who wants to kill him. So that's the image. Okay, and they eat and they drink and they sing and they bench. And again, I skip here just because it's 47 pages. But they spread out on long benches and colored boxes. I don't know the significance of colored boxes. I looked and tried to find it. I came up with nothing. They're all ready to go to sleep. But the students lie on the benches and they keep their eyes open, watching the Rebbe. And with everything that the Rebbe does, they look at him and they say, "What can we learn from what he did? What's the mystical significance of that gesture, of that comment?" They're analyzing everything that he does. You see the phrase, mountains upon mountains of intentions, which is a phrase pulled out of the Gemara, out of the Talmud. That's chapter one. It's not going to take us that long to get through everything else, but chapter one's a long chapter, and it sets the stage for the story. So we have Rav Avigdor the Parnas, whose daughter is on her deathbed. He is busy driving off Hasidim, because it's terrible that there are Hasidim. And you have Rav Uriel, who is humiliated, who issues a curse that he should lose somebody from his household, turning on its head a verse from Shmuel to do so, failing the test that Rabbi Avram David of Bechetch had passed, and of Buchach had passed, I'm sorry, I'm working on it. But the Hasidim have made their place outside of the town. Chapter 2 takes us back to the Hasidim first. The end of Shabbos is beautiful. There's snow at the end of Shabbos. It's beautiful. They're going to have their Malava Malka, their big meal associated with the end of Shabbos, the meal of King David, as it's identified in the writings of another Hasidish Rebbe, Reb Tzedek HaKohen of Lublin. Rav Uriel sits and he sings songs. He doesn't want to end Shabbos, because there is this idea that as long as Shabbos is going, the wicked who have been suffering in Gehenna, in hell, aren't going to have to suffer. When you end Shabbos, now they have to go back. So I don't know if they go by the time in Australia, or the time in Eastern Europe, or the time wherever. Maybe it's based on where they lived. Who knows? But he can keep them out of Gehenna by keeping Shabbos going. He has that kind of power. So he doesn't want to end Shabbos, and he prolongs it. And they have their Malava Malka. And here I call your attention to the paragraph that starts with the number 18, describing how they sat at this feast. And so they sat, the most holy, the Rav, Rabbi Uriel, crowned in reverence, and the light of his face like the light of the 7 days from creation, which is supposed to be light that's hidden away for the righteous. To his right, Eliakim Aryeh, a Jew who knew to rejoice on Simchas Torah and cry on Tisha B'Av. That's his praise. And beside Eliakim Aryeh laved the silent, who prayed with force until his teeth flew from his mouth. Right, that's like when you call the big guy tiny, right? The silent. And beside laved the silent Maram the Moel, a Jew of stature. And beside Maram the Moel, the elder from the village, he was the one who had brought the Torah scroll. There's a whole story about how he had made a Torah scroll and a victor had banished him and wouldn't let them use it, and now they're going to use it for this minion. It's another shtach to a victor. And beside the elder from the village, Nasanata, husband of Chayasara the storekeeper. And beside Nasanata, husband of Chayasara the storekeeper, Yaakov Yoshua, who was counted the assembly of important people. And beside Yaakov Yoshua, Ephraim Shlomo the great drinker. He began to spice the Rav's table with his jokes. And so on and so on. This is your group, that's the leader, and they're all described in all their glory. And then you get this story about Elimelech the water drawer. About whom the Baal Shem Tov, it's the same paragraph, about whom the Baal Shem Tov, great founder of Hasidus, had said, "Have you seen my friend Elimelech? When he prays, the gates of heaven are open." What is it about this person? It's not how many times he learned the Talmud. Each day he would draw water and fill the barrels of the needy for free, and pray at sunrise. Once he was coming from the well and he went to pray. It was harshly cold, his sleeve froze and stuck to his skin. He couldn't put on tefillin. He lowered the sleeve by the handles of the bolt until the flesh of his arm peeled, meaning he attaches the sleeve to the bolt and he pulls it off because he wants to put on tefillin. And his blood flows and he puts on tefillin, and they quote a line from Shir HaShirim, from Song of Songs, "And my hands dripped myrrh upon the handles of the bolt." No, it's not myrrh, it's blood for him. But that's another Song of Songs reference. Reb Uriel remembers the entrance of Shabbos and the tears, and now there is such joy, but he doesn't know, wait, maybe this is bad. Because there's this thing called the Klipa of Noga, which is a Kabbalistic concept of darkness, which is sometimes brought close to light on Shabbos, but it's actually dark and sinister. It's a mystical idea. And he prays to God, and his limbs are moved by the light of truth, and they go out, and they do another round of dancing, and they're all excited, so much so that Reb Uriel is afraid he's going to leave this world. And he has to cool himself off to remain in this world. End of chapter 2. So the Hasidim have ended Shabbos. They're celebrating together. They're joyous. And now we go back to Adel in chapter 3. On a bed of grief, Adel lay, and she sees the angel of death. And the description that you see here in the beginning of chapter 3 is straight out of the Talmud in the volume called Avodah Zarah. And she gives up her soul. However, while that's happening, her children are reading a book of Maisa HaTzadikim, wondrous deeds of Tzadikim. Tzadikim bringing miraculous healing. And here we're introduced. Sorry.
Yes, sir. I was very curious as to how they would have those books.
How? Who? Oh, those kids.
The kids.
And the answer is because there's a generation in between. Rabbi Meshulam is not the Kanoi, the zealot.
Yeah.
And also, the woman who's dying, Adel, is not the zealot either, as you'll see. It's Avigdor, the Parnas, who is, but the next generation is not.
But I would think that they'd be afraid to have it.
Yeah,
in
I know.
House.
It is. I hear you.
Yeah.
Well, Rabbi Meshulam hears the stories and he says, you know what? All hope has come and gone. All the kitzim, the kates is supposed to be the time of Mashiach. All the hope has come and gone. This can't be. I'm going to go to Rabbi Uriel and ask for mercy for my wife. Rabbi Victor finds out. He knows what's happened. And it's very telling. The line that he uses to say Rabbi Victor knew, Yadad Kalasher Naasa, is from Gilas Esther. When Mordechai knows about Haman's decree against the Jews, Yadad Kol Asher Naasa. So he's saying that to Rabbi Victor, the idea of going to the Hasidish Rebbe is like Haman decreeing to kill all the Jews. He's making that equation. Rabbi Victor turned his two ancient eyes down on his only daughter as she is dying, and he strengthens his thoughts with God's mercy, and then he thought, wait a minute, what if she actually lives? And my son-in-law went to the Rebbe. People are going to believe that Hasidim can do miracles. That can't be. And he prays with God to God for his daughter to die. That's like, I mean, that's what you're talking about here. That's that kind of villainy. There's no other word for it in a person.
Is that Sinam Chinam by any chance or related to Sinam?
I mean, he doesn't think it's Chinam. He thinks he's fighting for a cause. It's what we do to each other. That's what it is.
Couldn't you argue that he really felt that he was protecting?
Yes, and I'm going to come back to that. Once I get through the story, that's actually a theme I want to come back to, so hold me to that. Okay. Yes.
But that's not what...
We're going to come back to this. They go through the Shiva, which is obviously a terrible, like, heart-wrenching thing, and I just skipped it because I had no choice. And then he draws on a line from the Talmud about how the dead are eventually forgotten from the heart. And now we're introduced to what you may consider the main figure in the story. We're in chapter 3 already. It's about time. And that's Gershom. Gershom is the third generation of the family. You had, he's not the only one in that, but he's the key figure. You had Avigdor the Parnas. His wife is never in the story. She may be dead. We don't know. You have Avigdor the Parnas. You have his daughter Adel, Adel's husband Meshulam. And they have a bunch of kids. The only one, though, who we'll name is Gershom. Gershom is engaged to a woman by the name of Menucha, which is a very important name in this story. All the names are important, but you'll see later why this matters. But she, Menucha, is living in town with her parents and her family. Gershom is away in yeshiva studying. Gershom is not home when his mother passes away. He's off in yeshiva. Why didn't they summon him home with his mother dying? Why did they summon him home? Because their value is Torah study. That's it. He's going to study day and night. That's what he can do that's best for this world. That's what's best for his mother, is that he be off and studying. Let's not take away from his time in yeshiva in order to bring him home. So now, after the Shiva is over, Avigdor sits down to write a letter to his son. And he writes in the letter, you know, I have some degree of comfort. Because I remember that your mother, a blessed memory, when she was about 2 years old, fell into the river. And some guy saved her very heroically. That was a miracle. It must be that God wanted her to live long enough to be able to have children. So, even though I'm angry and upset, how could God take her from us? God gave her to us all these years so that she'd be able to have children first. And then he says to him in his letter to his grandson, one thing I ask of you, only one thing. Achashalti, right? Osav, Akesh, I have one thing to request. Don't join with those terrible Hasidim. That I ask of you. That's what he puts in the letter to his grandson, you know, after the loss of his daughter, his grandson's mother. The hatred is so consuming.
Is there significance that he uses David in both cases, one with the quote?
And the other way.
You asked a question.
Sorry, I just wanted to know.
No.
Because the curse comes from David's story, and
right.
Then here also the significance.
Interesting. I hadn't thought about it, but for sure you could. Mm-hmm. I mean, David is a fantastic.
Because what happened with his children too?
Okay, I hear it that way. I mean, he has tragedy upon tragedy. Mm-hmm. He loses children. I was going to say also that it's because he's a fantastic antecedent for the Hasidim. He's the one who goes out dancing in front of the Aron, and is, you know, and Michal, his wife, rebukes him for it, but she's wrong and he's right. So yeah, I think you're onto something with the theme of David in this story. I hadn't thought about it, but I think there's a lot to be said for it. Definitely a layer to look at. Okay, there's layer upon layer upon layer in this story that we're not going to see. Even just the fact that each of his sections, each chapter, and then within the chapter, each section has a heading. Mm-hmm. Which I'm not even going to touch on. Just there's no time. Chapter 4. We're now told about the arrival of spring. You're getting through the winter. The days are short, and Gershom is sitting in yeshiva and trying to study. He's in pain over his mother's passing, but he still pushes himself to study. And he remembers that she's dead. He begins to moan and cry. And here I wanted to call your attention to something. In chapter 4, it's towards the end of the paragraph that starts 29. When he remembered. You see that? When he remembered that she was dead, he began to moan and cry, and to desire and yearn and long for the day when he would return to his house and take her sidur, and join his voice with those of his young brothers when they stood in the synagogue and recited Kaddish. And he would cry on the neck of his father until his eyes wore out from tears. The image of the sitter. That's the hallmark of the Chassid. The Jew who finds his meaning in praying to God, not necessarily in the study hall. And we'll see that repeatedly in this, the association with his mother. His mother is not his grandfather. you'll see this. Well, I'll draw your attention to it a couple of times more as we go through this. But that's the Hasidish element that's already in Gershom from before.
Very, very, his feelings are really on the outside.
He's very expressive. He's very sensitive. You got it. That's going to be actually mentioned as well. Notice as well the next paragraph, the one up against 30. The youths were stretched out on their benches, and they devoured their nights in sleep. Who else in this story was stretched out on a bench at night? The Hasidim were, but they didn't sleep.
Right.
They watched their Rebbe to learn from their Rebbe. The boys in yeshiva, they conk out, they sprawl on the bench, and they go to sleep.
Now, is that yeshiva he studies, is that the Rabbi Galil or Galil? Or
we'll come to the Rabbi Galil. Possibly, but not necessarily. Rav HaGalil is a term for the regional rabbi, like a circuit rabbi who was the rabbi of the towns. He was not necessarily the rabbi of that yeshiva. I think probably not, because at some point in the book, in the story, Agnon mentions that it's a relative of his who actually runs the yeshiva. So I think he's not. I think he's just.
There's a point that they say that Rav wouldn't sign on the petition against the Hasidim.
Right. But Rav HaGalil is anti-Hasidim. That you see very clearly within the story. You'll see. We're going to get to that part.
When it comes to dinner.
Yes. So Gershom is trying to learn and pushing himself to do it, but he's so torn and he's so distraught, he can't get himself up in the morning. Right? You're supposed to rise for the service of your Creator, rise like a lion. Gershom, forget the lion. He can't get up at all. He doesn't awaken the dawn, which is the Talmud's phrase of what one should do. The shadows keep on crawling across the room while he's trying to get up. I mean, he's depressed.
Yes.
That's what we're, that's what we're talking about. And what does he learn? The end of my part of chapter 4 here. His heart was softened by the sensitivity he had inherited from his mother. There's the association explicitly. And he also softened it with popular agadot. Agadot, stories, which draw a person's heart to love of God.
Hasidus.
Right, Hasidus. As a matter of fact, earlier in that paragraph, I deliberately did not translate it. He ascended the San Sinim of wisdom. I gave you a footnote to Shir HaShirim, to Song of Songs. O Chazab is San Sinav. San Sinim, as I understand it, I think it's Ibn Ezra who says it. If you ever see a date palm, you know how you have the branches that have been broken off in years past? You have these little stumps? So that's what the San Sinim are. You can use them to climb the date palm. O Chazab is San Sinav. So that's what he's using, the San Sinim of wisdom. He's trying to climb, but he's reading Hasidus in order to try to grow. But it's another Shir HaShirim, it's another Song of Songs reference. Chapter 5. Gershom goes home for Pesach. He arrives home, he is mobbed by his siblings. They take his bags from his hand, they embrace, they hug, they kiss him, another one hangs on him and kisses him. And then Rabbi Avigdor asked Gershom whether he had completed a tractate and which tractate he had completed. Right? That's the question that Avigdor has for him. Not, how you doing? Not, let me hug and kiss you. Why does he do that?
Well, first of all, it's divided from a poem.
So part of it has to be that it's the pride in his learning, and part of it is what Ari said. Erev Pesach, there's supposed to be a fast of the firstborn. It's a very sketchy fast. The origin of it is very vague. And it's not done, because you're not supposed to fast Erev Pesach, because then you won't feel well when you go into the Seder, and you have to eat at the Seder. So what we do instead, it's supposed to be in gratitude to God for saving us when he takes the Egyptian firstborn. But what's usually done instead is that the firstborn go to a siyum, a celebration when you finish learning a volume of Talmud, and then you're allowed to eat. So he asks him, he's very by the book. Did you finish a volume of Talmud so that now you can eat? And then he tells the cook, okay, give him some food. Like, otherwise he's not having food. Like my poor grandson who just came home from yeshiva. So Gershom is greeted, and then you get a scene which I skipped, and I really would have loved. I should have translated it for you, because this is a very funny scene, where there's a debate going about whose Seder he's going to go to.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Where Rabbi Avigdor says, I want him to be with us, with our family. But his future in-laws say, well, he should be with us. And so they decide between themselves, what Gershom decide. And the in-laws are going to be the ones to ask him where he wants to go. So his father-in-law comes to him and says, we decided, you're coming with us. Gershom is none the wiser. So he ends up at their Seder. But he's very concerned because they don't have a Haggadah for him. He's looking around and he thinks they're going to make me read along with my future Kala, my future bride. That's not really so Sanua. That's not really right. They shouldn't be doing that. Turned out they had a Haggadah for him. But this is very authentic European. They didn't want to use it because it was newly made and the paste often had chametz in it. And there's a fear that the paste has not had a chance to harden, and therefore the chametz is actually edible. And so this is actually an established halacha that people observed, not to use the books unless they had had time for the paste to dry. So they don't want to use his new haggadah, but don't worry, we have another one for you. And he sits at the table, and they have the Seder, and I love this line. This is one of the best digests I've ever heard of a Seder. They made Kiddush over wine and read the haggadah. They drank and ate and drank and blessed and finished. That's it. Haggadah in a nutshell. I saw a 2-minute Haggadah. I went around by email last year. This beat the 2-minute Haggadah. So Rabbi Zindel takes out his pipe, right? But he falls asleep before he can even start on it. Rabbi Zindel is his future father-in-law. And then this beautiful scene. Gershon keeps on going with the Haggadah, right? Kalamar v'lasaper v'tzias mitzayim, raise them a shubach, is praiseworthy to keep on going. Menucha, his wife, is so happy. She's ecstatic. She feels good. And then they start singing back and forth Chagadya, and actually that's something that you're not supposed to do. Right? They say she's not his wife yet. She's his bride. She's his, to be. She's fiance, that's what I'm looking for. So Gershom has now gone from...
They shouldn't do it. Why? Because
Kol Isha. Because of Kol Isha. He's not supposed to be listening to her sin yet. He's gone from being very medaptic, very careful, right? I won't share a Haggadah with her.
Right.
To...
Singing a duet.
Singing a duet, exactly. Part of that may be the four cups of wine. But it's trying to show... This is where Gershom is going. Mm-hmm. He's shifting in his identity. Sorry?
Psychologically, it's soot and death.
Yeah. This is who he is. This is where he's finding comfort at this stage. And it continues after the Seder. He goes to sleep in his grandfather's room. Now, while it was still day, they had brought in his mother's bed on which to sleep so that he would lie and rest in pleasure. It was a good bed. He ascended the bed, recites the first paragraph of Shema. There's a whole discussion about whether you say Shema the night of the Seder. He covers himself in his mother's cover. He had some childishness in him, some immaturity. He imagines himself like a baby lying beside his mother. It's this closeness to his mother again, and that sensitivity. Until the master of dream comes and makes him sleep with verses from Song of Songs and the image of his betrothed. Then he feels like he has to get outside, and is now going later. He's now spending his time over Pesach, learning in the local yeshiva. But he feels like he has to get out. And he goes to tour in the city. And he ends up right near the shtibel of the chassidim. And the chassidim invite him in to make a minyan, not realizing who he is. And then they see him and they think, oh no, he's been sent to shut us down. But then they remember the curse and they say, no, our Rebbe has it under control. Don't worry about it. And then they see how he looks depressed. And they say, oh, okay, it's actually, he's not here for a mission, he just happened to end up here. They think it's chance. No, but they think it's chance right now. They think it's just, just happened to be. The room is small. It's a shtibel. They start davening, he doesn't realize. Then they get to the repetition of the Amidah and the Kiddushah, and they start saying Nakdishchav, which is what the Hasidim say, as opposed to Nikadesh, which is what the Misnagdim say. And he says, oh no, now I know where I am, as though beaten by a snake. But he loves what he's hearing. The davening is so pleasant. He feels at home. And so he doesn't want to leave. And then they see him, and they see how much he's enjoying it. And they say, oh, it's not chance that he's here. This is all from God that he's here. Yeah?
I didn't catch it when I read it, but when you're reading it out loud, the second reference to snake.
Where was the other one? Oh, bitten like the Rebbe had bitten him like a snake. I didn't catch that either, but you're right. The second snake bite in our story. Yeah. And I would venture to say it's not chance either. So.
Right, so it must be from Gan Eden's story.
Oh, take it back to that snake, maybe.
I don't know.
I don't know either. It's a good thought. So they finish Ma'ariv, they go out to dance. He wants to dance with them. I can't dance. I can't can't do it. He's watching them, but he's not watching them. And then the line that, how beautiful are your feet, O princess, that's a reference to Shir Hashirim, to Song of Songs. He finally puts down his book and he just focuses on watching them dance. He can't dance himself, but he watches them. He loved this. The elixir of life is bubbling in his limbs. He's so excited and he leaves and he greets an elder who rebukes him for having gone there. Right? I never entered there. You just came to town and look at you. You immediately go into their house. And in those days, he doesn't mean Tehillim or Eov, Job, which bring rest to the soul. I don't understand what he means when he says Job brings rest to the soul. It brings rest to my soul. I like Job. But most people do not associate Job with that at all, and I don't know what to do with that reference. But he reads Reishit Chochma, which is a work of Musar. It's a work of Kabbalistic rebuke. He sees himself suffering in Gehenna because I've become like the Hasidim. And he cries bitterly from his pain, and he's ill. And they think he's ill like Adel, his mother was ill, and they don't know what to do. And that brings us to chapter 6. His grandfather decides, let's make a party. Everybody needs a party. So we're going to make a party, but it's misnagid party. It's not fun party. This is a Rebbe Vigder party. So he's going to make the party to celebrate the fact that his son-in-law is now 36 years old, which tells you a little bit about the age that they were marrying, right? Because his son-in-law is old enough that he's marrying off his own kid. And it's not surprising. This is Eastern Europe, end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century. That's what you get. So, but he says he's now.
But I have to just stop for a minute because I think at this point we see a different aspect of a Victor.
Yeah.
That he really is concerned about his son.
I'm going to come back to that too. Okay. And now I actually am going to say, don't ask questions now, because I just looked at the time and realized that it's getting late and there's a lot to talk about. So I'm going to actually go with this at this point. So Rebbe Vigder makes a feast to celebrate the fact that he's now 36, because there's a verse that says, men of blood and trickery, they will not live out half their lives. But now, knowing that the standard lifespan in Tehillim and Psalms is 70 years, he's now exceeded the half. That means he's not going to be under this curse. So they're going to make a party. And he invites the elders. And Menucha's friends talk to her about how wonderful Gershom is. Look at how learned he is. And Menucha is not interested. She considers it prattle. She tries to distract them because Menucha understands Gershom. She gets him. And she knows that it's not the learning that brings him comfort. It's not what makes him happy. So she says, here, have a basket of fruit. That's what she says to them. In the meantime, you get the seven councilmen together. And here you get the line in paragraph number 45. To fulfill the statement of our sages that those of refined mind in Jerusalem would not recline at a feast unless they knew with whom they were reclining, Rabbi Avigdor opened and introduced everybody. That line is the line that Agnon uses when he makes his speech accepting the Nobel Prize. He turns to the committee in Stockholm and he says to the King of Sweden, those of refined mind in Jerusalem would not recline at a feast unless they knew with whom they were reclining, so let me introduce myself. And then he talks about how, through Titus, he ended up being born in exile instead of in Jerusalem and so forth. What a speech. I love that speech. But that's what he uses here as well. But look at how they introduce the people at the feast. It's meant to contrast with the meal of the Hasidim. The meal of the Hasidim, they were all regular people who were known for praying really loud or knowing to rejoice on Simchas Torah and cry on Tisha B'Av, right? These... Rabbi, the elder official who sits to the right of his eminence is Rabbi Yaakov, son of Rabbi Yitzchak, from the grandchildren of the milkmen who wouldn't eat meat from Shabbos to Shabbos and the line of the holy Shalach. The official who sits behind is Rabbi Moshe Cohen, grandson of the Ot Emet, who is mentioned by rabbis of the generation in their responsa, who struck the men of the accursed sect of Shabtai Tzvi with the rod of his mouth. And that one over there, Rabbi Yosef Shmuel, studied Torah standing for 25 years and learned the entire Talmud 42 times. Because the verses Vidibarta bum in gematria, numerical value is 42. I'm not going to go into the whole thing now. The point is that it's trying to show you the contrast in the groups. And whereas the Hasidim at their meal rejoice and sing songs and get close to God, at this meal it's a contest. I'm going to do a pilpul. Pilpul means a lesson in Torah study which has no practical ramifications. We're going to ask a whole bunch of questions and give this very intricate answer, weaving together sources and tortured logic, in an answer that we know likely was never intended by the people whose works we are discussing, but it demonstrates great intellectual acumen and mastery of sources. That's what a pilpul is. That's what we're going to do with the meal, and then we'll have Gershom try to argue the pilpul. And the chazan sings a song, but he doesn't want to tell them that the song came from a passerby who might have been a chassid. It came from Sinai, like the Torah. And then you get this, they start telling stories, and here the regional rabbi, Rabbi Galil, tells a story about how he humiliated a student who had gone over to the Hasidim. Right? That's the story that he tells, and that's how you know that he's not a fan of the Hasidim. And the humiliation that he did is taken from a story in Tanakh involving King David, by the way. So they have this big party. It doesn't work. It doesn't cheer up Meshulam at all. Meshulam goes wandering out in the streets. He sees the fields. Gershom, not Meshulam. Meshulam is the father of Gershom. And he says, you know what? You have to go out and wander. You have to eat cakes. You have to go enjoy yourself a little bit. That's what Meshulam's advice is. Gershom is so upset. The students around him see that he's upset. But they think he's pushing himself in Torah. They think he's a role model. He's amazing. We should all be like him. And Gershom is miserable. And one student says to him, you know, I see you're depressed. You should go to the Rebbe. And Gershom would love to go to the Rebbe. And one day he decides, I'm going to go to the Rebbe. And he goes out on the street to go there. And he collapses before he can get there. And he ends up being brought home by one of the Hasidim. And he's so happy that I didn't actually, you know, make good on what I wanted to do. But that was what would have saved him had he gone to the Rebbe. Because what happens instead, and this is the end of the story, is that the Chozer comes to town. A Chozer is a position within the Hasidic community. The Rebbe on Friday night, and on Shabbos in general, will tell Divrei Torah, words of Torah, at his tish, at his table. The Chozer's job is to memorize what the Rebbe says and then write it down after Shabbos. Chozer is to review. So he's the reviewer of the Rebbe's teachings. So he's somebody who is learned, somebody with a good memory, but committed to the Hasidim. And he travels, this Chozer travels from place to place trying to spread Hasidic ideas. Well, he lands at the table of Rebbe Victor. We don't get a real explanation of how he ended up there. But he ends up at the table of Rebbe Victor, and he sits there Friday night at the meal, and he's so upset because he sees that Rebbe Victor is sitting there with a book. And they're all sitting there with books. And the Shabbos queen is crying, like, hello, what happened to me? It's the opposite of what he wants. But he recognizes the value of Gershom. And so he starts training Gershom secretly in Hasidus. He takes passages of the Talmud, but explains them in Hasidish ways. If you ever want a taste of that, if you read a work called Sidkana Tzadik by Rav Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin, he does this. And so he draws Gershom into Hasidus, and Gershom gets closer to God while hiding it from his family. He stops his regular learning. Now he's only learning from the Chozer. And then ultimately, at the end of the story, he comes to shul on Friday afternoon, and they're saying Shir Hashirim, Song of Songs, and his heart departs while saying Song of Songs. Quoting the verse, Nashi Yas Abedabro, my soul left when God spoke, his soul leaves him. And as the story ends, so died Gershom, grandson of Rabbi Avigdor, for Rabbi Avigdor had fought with Rabbi Uriel, with the Hasidim he had fought. That's your story. There's a lot to say about the story. I'm going to confine myself to a few notes, because I don't know how much time we have. I remember the first time I talked for this, you said like an hour and a quarter. Is that right?
No time. I don't...
Well, I don't want to hold people past their expectations. That's...
We're all here. Nobody has left yet.
Okay, if someone has to, they should. Okay, so a few things. And there's a lot of imagery to talk about here. Feasts and snow and Shabbos and all that. But that I'm going to skip. The contrasts of the Hasidim and the Misnagdim are very important. This is going to come back to the points that you were making. The groups at the feasts are an obvious contrast. The believing and earthy Hasidim, the erudite and ascetic Misnagdim on the other side. The business about who sleeps on the benches and what they do while they're sleeping on the benches is meant to draw a contrast. All the times when Agnon says, and at that same time, this was happening with the other one. The joy that the Hasidim have with their simple food in the Malava Malka, right, as seen in chapter 2, versus the lack of joy at the feasts that they make, that the Misnagdim make, that Rabbi Victor makes. There's no description of happiness at that meal. None. That's just not what it's about. The attitude that they have towards their Rebbe, the Hasidim adore the Rebbe. What's going on with the Misnagdim? They're all lucky to fight with the Rebbe. Their Rabbi, Rabbi Galil, says a pilpul, and now I'm going to dispute him. And it's expected that he's going to dispute him. It's a constant debating. It seems clear to me that within the story, Agnon sides with the Hasidim in general. Because Rebbe Victor is made into such a villain. I mean, praying for his daughter, it's unconscionable. He sides with the Hasidim. However, he depicts each group as pious in its own way. The Misnagdim are serious about their learning. It's not shallow. It's not for show. They take it very seriously. That's what Rabbi Victor prizes in Gershom. What are you learning? Staying in yeshiva. That's, you know, that's the biggest deal for him, even before he's going to hug him when he gets home. Each group believes that God manages the world. Did you notice that? The innkeeper, with the whole turnabout in chapter 1, of, aha, now we get a minion. See that God arranged everything for us to get a minion. In chapter 2, Rav Uriel talks about how his daughter was saved once, and God saved her, and okay, now he has taken back that which he gave us. That was Rav Victor in chapter 3. Rav Uriel in chapter 2 said, oh, you know, it all worked out for us to leave the town. That was actually good for us as Hasidim. This is all from God. That was Rav Uriel in chapter 2. Rav Victor in chapter 3 about her death. The Hasidim, when they say, oh, you know what, he ended up at our shtiebel for a reason. It wasn't just chance that he ended up there. They sincerely believe in God. They sincerely believe that God is running their world. And each group gets along internally very well. The Rav HaGaliel, it's emphasized, says this whole pilpul lesson. It's torn down by his student Gershom. What's his response?
Wonderful.
Wonderful. That was great. You did a great job. He's not prideful. He's not arrogant. At the same time, the warmth and the down-to-earth character of the Hasidim is portrayed with greater affection and admiration. And the Hasidim are portrayed as innocent victims. You know, not Rav Uriel did his curse, but the Hasidim fundamentally are innocent victims. They're getting thrown around. We didn't do anything to hurt anybody. They brought Gershom home. They're nice people. Gershom himself is an intellectual who needs the spiritual. He needs it. And here I come back to names. Avigdor. What does the name Avigdor mean?
Put a fence,
right? The master or father who put a fence. But who is Avigdor in Chumash? Moshe. Avigdor is another name for Moshe in the Midrash. Mm-hmm. Moshe the lawgiver. Mm. Who, by the way, had a son by the name of Gershom?
Moshe.
Right. So that's who Gershom is. He's the son of the great lawgiver. In this case, he's the grandson of the great lawgiver. He's introduced to us as this very dedicated student who's off in yeshiva, who excels in his scholarship, impressing everybody, including this big regional rabbi, the Rav HaGaliel. But he longs for his mother's sitter. He imagines her cuddling him to sleep. He has the sensitivity of his mother. His true solace in learning comes from the Hasidic and Kabbalistic works. Where he finds his real rest, I use the word advisedly, is with Menucha. With her.
And also Gershom,
Ger Hayisi Beretz Nachuya. Good, thank you. You're right as well. The name Gershom is I was a stranger in a foreign land. Ger Hayisi Beretz Nachuya. He is a stranger, in this case, in his own land. Which actually, when you come to think of it, Moshe was in Egypt. I mean, in this case, Gershom is named in biblical for Midian. Moshe is a stranger in Midian. But he's a stranger wherever he goes. That's his fate. He dies in the wilderness. He doesn't get home. That's its own story about Moshe. But this is what you're seeing here. And then, of course, the curse. You know, this curse which signifies the reversal of what happened in Tanakh. You're supposed to be able to come back. And now, in fact, it's used as as an attack. And here's something very interesting. I brought you on your sheet. If you take a look now, please, at source number 5. I'm not going to do the whole thing. But this is a piece from Sichot Haran, Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. And again, I'm going to stick to the English, but you should look at the Hebrew when you get a chance. His grandson, the grandson of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, was lying in bed with smallpox, God save us. And he complained before me greatly that he felt great pain from this. This is the recorder of it, because Rabbi Nachman didn't write his own teachings. It was written down by a student, Rabbi Nassan, I think. He told me then that there are divine ways which one cannot understand. It is found regarding the Arizal, in the 16th century, that he lost a son. He said the reason was that he had revealed a secret to his student, Rabbi Chaim Vital. In truth, the Ari had needed to reveal it to him. Rabbi Chaim Vital had pushed him greatly, and this pushing had required him to reveal it. For the Ari said he had come to this world only to repair the soul of Rabbi Chaim Vital. So the Ari said, I have to teach this lesson, but it's going to cost me my son. And he taught the lesson anyway. Heaven required him to reveal the secret to him, and yet he was punished as noted. This is one of the divine ways which one cannot understand rationally at all. From Rabbi Nachman's words, it was understood regarding himself that all of his pain and suffering, the pain of his children, may they live, were all because he worked to bring us close to God. Even though he was required to do this, for God certainly wants this as God plans, lest anyone who is pushed away remain pushed away. The same line from the curse. But again, there it's about being drawn close to God. Suffering in this world in order to get close to God, it is now turned into a curse. Agnon is clearly channeling this. We've discussed on other occasions, Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs pointed this out to me, that Gershom Scholem and others made the link between Agnon and the work of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. That's where he's getting this from. So the curse of Reb Uriel is not only the reversal of a verse in Shmuel, but also a reversal of what Rabbi Nachman did, saying that they're suffering to bring a person back to God, not suffering about being pushed away.
But here, you see, he has to do something that's going to cost him his son.
Yes.
And that's viewed positively.
Yes.
And yet in the story, it's like, oh, how could he do this?
Yes. And that's the thing. They each believe that what they're doing is right.
Yes.
He thinks he doesn't think this is baseless hatred. He doesn't think this is sinas chinam. Avigdor believes that this is his mission in life. Scary thought, but that's exactly what he believes.
But there's also an illusion. Nothing is straight and clear. He creates other little dots in between. The simple people seem to be alluding that the mother's illness has passed down to the Gershom.
Yes.
And I don't know what they're talking. I mean, it's just subtly hinted. We don't really know. What did he get from his mother? They think that he's dying like his mother. That something was. She was ill with something mentally, and that.
They think it's the sensitivity.
They
think it's the sensitivity. You have to remember the medicine of that era.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that people are overly sensitive and therefore they need to go out to the spa and they need to whatever or else they're going to die of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the sensitivity that has been passed down that is poisoning him. That's their notion. So I want to say a few summary things. You want to say?
The question that was asked, the words Devik and Bidduk appear quite a few times.
Interesting.
What role does that play in what happens to the characters in the story?
Right. So I think that the use of it is not Dibuk associated, even though you're right, it's the same word, but from Dvekut, the idea of clinging to God, which is a centerpiece of Hasidic thought. That's your goal. One of the ways to capture the debate between the Hasidim and the Mitnagdim is what's your goal in life as a Jew? Mitnagdim believe the goal is shlemut, perfection. To check off all the mitzvot, I served God perfectly. I didn't make any mistakes. Hasidim argue that it's dveikut, be close to God, that close feeling. And even if there was a mistake here, there was a mistake there, but it led me to become somebody who would draw close to God, that's my ideal. So I think that's the context for which they keep using the word to be dveik. Not about a dibuk spirit.
The fact that when a person is acted against, the hurt that he suffers will be repeated in his dibuk attaching itself to somebody else.
Maybe. I just don't see it here. It's an interesting idea, but I would need to see where it fits into the story. Can you find I guess it would be sort of Hanidach part two as yes. The ghost of Gershom comes
called,
back.
Yeah. It's called the Dibuk by asking.
Okay. So on a simple level, you could read this as a story of hatred, right? Most simply, most blatantly, Avigdor's hatred for the Hasidim. He believes he is waging a war for God, right? How long will the sin be on my hands? The Rav HaGalil, the regional rabbi, supports this at the meal. He prefers his daughter's death. And it's not just from Avigdor. The Mitnagdim in general, they goad the non-Jews into attacking us. They give them liquor. Right? I skipped it when reading it now, but it was in the translation. They give them liquor to get them drunk and then sick them on the Hasidim. But it's also the hatred in the other direction. This curse by Reb Uriel, who falls into the trap that Rabbi Avram David of Buchach did not, right? That's a piece of this as well. So that by the end of the story, the word Hanidach, the banished one, could actually apply to several figures in the story. It could apply to almost anyone in this story. It could apply to Adel. right, who died after the curse. It could apply to Gershom, who was the one who could have healed the communal rift and now is gone. He could have been the figure who would be the merger, the Avram David. It could apply to the Rebbe, right? He's also Nidach. He's pushed out. He wasn't allowed into the city. It could be Rebbe Victor, right? Who will never gain back that which he has lost. He's also the banished one in that sense. The only ones who I can't really speak about are Rebbe Meshulam and Menucha. I mean, these poor bereft people, right? Meshulam has lost his wife and his son. The Menucha has lost her fiance.
But there's irony in Meshulam, because he's not Shalim.
Yeah. Right, if I take Meshulam as the one who has everything, the one who is complete, then he is the opposite of it. Also a valid point. But on another level, and I like reading it this way, so I can avoid reading it the other way, it's a story of love. It's very much a story of love on multiple levels, and it's influenced by the Rebbe's of Agnon. The most obvious part is Shir HaShirim. Song of Songs is here throughout the book. In chapter 1, the Hasidim and the Rebbe sing it while leaving the city before Shabbos. In chapter 2, Elimelech the Hasid bleeds for a mitzvah. And we invoke Song of Songs, Akapot HaManul. In chapter 3, Gershom climbs the San Sinei HaChochmah, the San Sinim, the stubs of the date palm. In chapter 4, Gershom and Menucha sing it to each other at the Seder. In chapter 5, they use it to describe the dancing of the Hasidim at the Shtibol. Mayafu pa'amayech, how beautiful are your feet. In chapter 6, Gershom can't extinguish his love for Reb Uriel. Mayim rabim lo yuchlu l'chabot et ahava, great water cannot extinguish the love. And in chapter 7, the Misnagdim sing it. Everybody sings this before Shabbos, and Gershom dies with it. This is a song of love. You got it. More than that, different types of love. The love between the Hasidim and their Rebbe. The love of the Hasidim and the Rebbe for God, and God back to them, this chesed that he gives them, and so on. The love between Gershom and God, right? This whole story about Gershom and his relationship with God is fascinating, and really deserves, you know, more study. And, of course, the relationship between Gershom and Menucha, who's the only person with whom he's comfortable after his mother is gone. First it was Gershom and his mother, and then it's Gershom and Menucha. Now, this theme of love is certainly attributable to Rabbi Nachman, right? Gershom Sholem notes that connection to Rabbi Nachman. That's a very much Rabbi Nachman theme, this theme of love. And more than that, I brought you on the sheets, if you can bear another source. Source number 7. Aryeh Veinman, Agada v'Amanut, Iyunim v'Yitzirat Agnon. He says, you know, on various levels, Hanidach recalls Ma'aseh ben Harav, one of 13 stories of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov's deeds. It's on the last page. Common to the two stories are the situation and model of a student from an anti-Hasidic family who longs to know joy in his Torah and who is drawn to the tzaddik so that he will fill that which is lacking. Sound familiar? In both stories, the opponent is a relative of the hero. And in both stories, the intellectual atmosphere does not meet the spiritual needs of the hero and strangles him spiritually. That's totally where Agnon gets his story. He's pulling it from there. And you see the parallels. This is a Rabbi Nachman story. Yeah.
The fact that the potential for unifying them with love dies.
Yes.
And so we're really left with, not that it's unsolved, but we're left with the split.
Yes.
And I think that that's, I see it more rationally than you do, clearly, but I think...
I'm good with that, Pearlie.
But I think that that's what he's in a sense, he's explaining this. Where she says, "See, he's explaining the rifts."
Oh, that's for sure.
Within the Jewish people that seem to go on and on and
but
on
he's also
forever. I mean, you weren't here when we were growing up. When Rav Price's followers and Rav Ox's followers came to blows. I mean,
Unfortunately. This is a story that has played out in Jewish community.
Yes.
In the community that I lived in before coming to Toronto, you had two shuls in the end of the 19th century. You had the Polish shul and the Rosh Hashul.
Right.
right? Because the Poles and the Russians, they weren't going to daven together.
And it wasn't a question of Hasidim and Mithnagdim.
No.
And yet there were cases, like, do you know the Emersons? Or?
Yeah.
Okay, well, Stanley Emerson, his father was a Litvak with a good Mithnagid lineage, and his name is Zalman Schneier.
So it can happen.
It tells you something yes. about movement.
Yes. For sure. But what I'm trying to get at when I call it a story of love is in the potential for healing that rift. And I want to note one more thing, and with this this will be my last point. I think it is about healing that rift because you see, he writes this in the years 1909 to 1919. Where did Agnew live in those years?
Germany.
In the beginning of those years.
In Israel.
In which city in Israel?
Tel Aviv.
Yafo. And who did he become close to in that time? Who's the chief rabbi of Yafo in those days?
Rav Kook.
And Rav Kook is the influence there. That's the image of the one who will unite the signs. Take a look at I knew this had to be true, and then I had to go online and find somebody else who would say it, who knows Agnew better than I do. So lo and behold, the centrifugal novel, Stephen Cass, source number 8. I love this. I have to buy this book, because I keep reading bits and pieces of it, and I haven't. Get it. Reflecting on the virtual silence in Agnew's fiction concerning Rabbi Avraham Isaac Cohen Kook, among the few individuals to have had a profound influence on him, Michael Shashar appears to be expressing the attitude held by many. His explanation, supported variously through others as well, is that, quote, he was afraid to approach Rav Kook's grand image. He loved Rav Kook, lest he fail in his task. However, as a guest for the night proves, the author did include and publish an account of the Rav Kook in its early editions. Because what happens is, when you compare the manuscripts over time, the first versions of A Guest for the Night, or the Oreach, thank you, the first editions of it actually are explicitly Rav Kook. And then he papers it over in later editions. In what seems to be one such example, the guest in his argument with the rabbi of Shibush echoes the views of the Rav Kook as he defends the young Zionists from the Shibush rabbi's accusations that by playing soccer they desecrate the Sabbath. During a later confrontation, having added more to the previous statement, the guest concludes, Father in heaven, if you can suffer them, we can suffer them too. It's the image of Rav Kook as a uniter that he's channeling here in this story. And this is, it's lost hope in this sense, because it didn't happen in this story. And the price is paid by the community for it. But I think that's what he's pushing towards. He's describing the hatred, but he's preaching the love. That to me is what's going on in this story, which you don't need a section now at the end saying implications for us today. The story is does that better than I could, except for one note, which you can't lose in this. There's so much of the focus here is the community, but there's also a message here about forcing your child into a mold that doesn't work for them. You know, the Avigdor is so adamant he's got to learn in yeshiva and he's going to do this, and he's such a terror in his household that poor Gershom has to hide and be neurotic about his desire to go to the Hasidim, and it tears him up, and ultimately it's what kills him. That piece of it can't be forgotten. That's also an element of this. So I want to thank you very much for inviting me. I'm so glad to have the opportunity to do this.
Historically, yes. Rav Kook was a Zionist. He was Mizrahi. But was he? What was his relation to Hasidut? His origin, like
so, he's a Hasid, Rav Kook.
He was a Hasid.
Well, he's Litvish. He learns in Volozhin, actually.
Yeah.
But he is decidedly Hasidic, Kabbalistic. He writes poetry. He Rav Kook himself is that bridge.
Hasidic more.
Like so I don't know. I don't know from a genealogy perspective. I don't remember what his father is and his mother is and so on. But he learns in Volozhin, which is bastion of the Misnagdim, right? Founded by Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin, chief student of the Vilna Gaon, who was anti the Hasidim. But on the other hand, he's chassid from the chassidim in terms of his reaching out.
Now, the other thing is with the Rav Uriel's curse. Historically, the chassidim, I can see Agnew, he's an artist, and he had a love of chassidism himself. You can see it from all his writings, more or less. But he's very realistic, and he doesn't give you a perfect picture. So the curse fits very well in here. And this, I mean, it's very realistic, and it also balances the Hasidic love with the white picture with a bit of dark.
Right. He doesn't whitewash anybody in this story.
Exactly. But the question is, in history, we know that the Mitnagdim cursed and hated the Hasidim. Was there such an instance of a Hasidic tzaddik pronouncing a curse? Because it seems to me that's very extreme for a Hasidic.
I don't know.
I'm just wondering.
I would be shocked if it hadn't happened.
Really?
Yes. But I honestly don't know.
It's human, you know.
Yeah, it's human, but it seems, I don't know, everything was so beautiful in your films.
Yeah. The Eshel Avram proves you can triumph over it. Right, Rav Avram David of Buchach is in that position.
Yeah, like you said, he controlled himself.
He controlled himself, but that stands out.
I see.
That's what I would say. I'm gonna say to stop with this. I'm gonna stick around for a few minutes still if people wanna, you know. But knowing that it's already 10 o'clock, I feel like, you know, I should liberate people who want to go.
No, I wondered if you'd let anybody else ask a question.
Oh yeah, no, please. Please, I'm just saying that anyone who has to go should go. Don't feel
it. We never go that quickly.
Okay.
You said that you wrote this manuscript in 1919.
1909 through 1919. You wrote it in stages.
Yeah. Wouldn't you have written this book? Could you have written this book in 1945?
That would require somebody with more knowledge of Agnon than I have.
I'm not talking about statistics here.
No.
But the loom of the destruction of European Jewry,
right.
Would he have been able to write this kind of book?
Right. I understand the question, but I think I would need to really be a better scholar of his work post-war. We know that he writes a lot post-war about Buchach and about Eastern Europe and about the longing to go back to that which is destroyed. One example was the story that I did actually here, To Father's House, Levet Abba, which is post-war, and it's about the home that isn't even there anymore and you can't get back to no matter how hard you try. Another one, actually the first one that I did here, but Derek was also, right, the image of this shul of the martyrs. Could he have seen them in this kind of critical light and describe them that way is an interesting question.
We have the answer from the story we studied with Rav Gemara, and I'm trying to remember.
Hasiman?
No, the one with the blood.
Oh, that is so right.
And when also he's so critical.
Hadom Bakissa, yeah. I think it's called Hadom Bakissa.
Uh-huh. He's so critical of the rifts, and Rav Gemara said that this was his most overt story about the Shoah, because he was showing some of the things that some of the involved the non-Jews in their disputes, and I remember him saying that this was his story about the Shoah.
And a supplemental, I like to use the comma, you said that Avigdor might be modeled on Moshe Rabbeinu. What about the Vilna Gaon?
Well, I think
whose ferocity against
I think that it's an archetype. It's not Moshe literally, because there is no one who loves people and has a bigger heart for people than Moshe. I mean, how many times has he put himself on the line to defend the people who have rebelled against him when God wants to destroy them? There's no one with a bigger heart than Moshe. But what he's doing is he's taking the identity of lawgiver, which can be associated with the Vilna Gaon for sure, and applying that. But in the original stories, in the original events of the rift between Hasidim and Misnagdim, nothing is really as simple as it's been made out to be. For example, even though one of the major points of contention is the use of Kabbalah by the Hasidim, the Vilna Gaon was a Kabbalist, among other things. He wrote works that we would classify as mystical. His chief student, the Nefesh HaChaim, Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin, wrote Nefesh HaChaim, which is a mystical work, among other things. There are multiple aspects to the work. but it is decidedly a mystical work involving the different parts of the soul, and you can't, the lines don't really, it doesn't line up clearly. You also can't say that the Misnagdim didn't value intent and kavana, even though they don't do it the way the Hasidim do. They don't make it the be-all and end-all. But it's not as though it's foreign to them. And the Hasidim don't, you know, leave Torah. They're having a minion, maybe at a different time, but they're having a minion, they're dominating. There is this Devar Torah. It's not like Torah is, you know, and Torah study is foreign to them. It's not. The lines are more blurry than that. But I think in terms of him identifying Moshe in particular, I think it's because it lends itself to the lawgiver model, more so than if he had, let's say, named him Eliyahu, the first name of the Gaon of Vilna. I think it resonates more this way. Yeah, and then?
Okay. So, it's not my question, but just Moshe is the lawgiver with a huge heart, but he also commanded sometimes the death of the heart. So that's why, like, I want to go back to the story of Rav Nachman of Breslov.
Yeah.
Because here he caused the death of his son because he had to.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and this is viewed, okay, this is what he had to do. Same with Avigdor here.
Yeah, I agree, but the way
when you said it was so vile in a way, that wasn't your word. I can't remember exactly.
Villainous.
Villainous.
No, villainous wasn't that. Villainous was when he prays for his daughter's death.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking
about. That's what you mean.
About.
Okay.
That's what I'm talking about.
Right.
Now, she was on her deathbed.
Right.
So I think here it's like,
I mean, I'm, you're actually triggering a separate thought, which I wonder about now. Two pieces. One from Chumash, and then one from Midrash / Tanakh. The Gershom, who is Moshe's son, almost died.
Right.
What was the story?
Well, so confusing.
It's a weird story. Yeah. Moshe is told to go to Egypt. He goes, he doesn't circumcise his son, and on the way he almost gets killed, apparently because he hasn't circumcised his son. He is doing God's will, almost at the cost of his son's life. So that's one. The other, and this is a strange story, I mean that one is strange, but this one is capital S strange. There's a passage in Tanakh which speaks of somebody that by the name of Yonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe, who was a priest for Avodah Zarah. But the way the word Menashe is written, it's with a small nun, as though it's Moshe. And that leads to this very odd idea that Moshe actually had a grandson who, as the Talmud tells it, was not an idolater, but he was raised, he became a servant in the house of idolatry, and therefore he's viewed as being like a priest for the idol. And there's this whole backstory to it, in which we're told, and again, this is very difficult to understand, but we're told that Moshe makes a deal with his father-in-law, right? Moshe marries Tzipporah. Tzipporah's father, Yitro, had been a priest for idolatry before he saw the light. So Yitro says, you know, I'm a seeker. I want my grandchildren to be seekers. So the deal is, Moshe, you can marry my daughter on condition that your firstborn is going to be trained in idolatry. Let him not just be raised as Moses' son. Let's let him see the world a little bit, and he'll decide for himself what he wants to be. And then he ends up in this idolatry as the story plays out. And you have to wonder when you read that, and I thought about this when I was preparing it and then sort of dismissed it as, I don't know what to do with this, but the Avigdor, who has forced Gershom into a certain track, and that has, you know, led him off, in this case, because it was against his nature, not because he, you know, he views the Hasidus as idolatry. It's sort of the flip side. I wonder if that isn't part of this image also. It's so hard, because Agnon is familiar with all of this. He makes that clear over and over again in his stories.
Yeah, I don't think it's an accident that Gershom is described as collapsing at the fork of the road. So he never made the decision, of what road he hit.
Good.
And his name is Gershom because he's estranged from himself.
Right.
Because he couldn't make that decision.
He couldn't make that decision. Good. So. Right. Be'im HaDerech. also, by the way, Im Haderach. I don't know if that's intentional, the mother piece of it. I don't know. All right.
One quick question. We talk about names and whatever. One name, and I don't have any thoughts, is Rabbi Uriel.
Uriel.
Where?
The light of God. I think it's a very loaded name. It's the light of God. This is the way he's viewed by his followers. That's the role of the Rebbe, is to be the light of God. Yeah, I believe that's what that's...
Does it go back to any previous Uriel?
That I don't know. That's a good question. There is so much more in this story.
There is a Rav Uri Mistralis. Rav Uri Mistralis.
Who was that?
He was a student of... I think it was like a student of the best.
Really?
They call him the Saraf when he...
Oh, that would fit this
one. Wow.
That would fit this word. That's interesting. See, there are lots of trails to be picked up in doing this.
Well, Rabbi Zirin, the Shabbat, when you spoke up north, his talk, I just noticed, was symbolism of names.
Names, yes.
And I'm hoping to reach out. I'm going to be contacting him about speaking on that topic. So you were not there when he spoke, because that was sort of his specialty, the name.
Well, no, it was just we worked out our commitment so that each of us was taking care of something. So, no, I didn't get to see when he spoke, but yes, he loves the idea of names, and in general, he's a fantastic speaker. You'll enjoy it when he comes to speak.
So I'll be in touch with him.
Yeah.
As long as you... prepare him.
Oh, yeah, I already prepared him. He knows to anticipate it, yes.
Because I spoke to Lori Grisman, and she's too busy, but she said eventually she may come before
also
six
good.
Years.
Okay.
Speak.
Great.
And how are you thanking our speaker?
Okay, on behalf of the group.